Accession number 28936, Reel 1.
Mr. Clyde, Wilkie's on Reel 1. Can you tell me where and when you were born, please?
Kuling, North China.
And when was that?
21, I think. You'll never hear of it. It's gone, the place. Yeah.
Why were you born out there? What were your parents doing?
My father was a great wanderer. He wrote that book on birds and he walks and so forth. Yeah. And he was a friend of Chiang Kai-shek. So forth.
So did you grow up in China, or did you...
No, I was a little boy there, and then I was sent home, or brought home, for kindergarten and prep school. I went to prep school when I was six, I think it was. They wouldn't let you do it today. Yeah. And indeed spent some of my holidays there. Yeah.
And given the career that you had with the Fleet Aero,
yeah.
When you were younger, did you have any interest in aviation or naval matters at all?
Well, at my Dragon School, at prep school, one of those air shows came along. Name escapes me.
Would it be Alan Cobham?
That's it, yes. And I went up, they were at Port Meadow, and I had a flight. It cost 5 shillings, I think. God knows what in every cadet. Anyway, it frightened me. They didn't have any parachutes, they didn't strap you in or anything. That was the first time I flew. But it didn't make me particularly interested, it was just something to do.
So as you were growing up, were you aware of sort of like the situation that was developing in Europe?
Oh yes, very much so. We all expected a war, and our schoolmasters predicted it, and so on and so forth.
Did you think that at that stage you might be involved?
Well, one assumes so, yeah. Question when it happened. You see, we trained in the Corps, we had the OTC in it. Which I couldn't take at all seriously. Always in trouble with those things they had wrapped around, what do they call them? They wrapped around your legs.
Oh, putties.
Putties, yeah, they were always trailing behind me. But other people took it seriously.
And given the fact that you were aware that the situation was rising, were you interested in the choice of one of the armed services? Was it that point?
Not in the least, no. I was at Trinity when I went up to Trinity in September 39, I suppose. And I joined yacht patrol at Dunkirk time. And that was a civilian business. You just went on one of these silly little yachts and hung about on the horizon to see if the Germans weren't coming. And I was disbanded in September. And I went back to Oxford. And my stepfather advised me to take a civil service exam for permanent commission, which I did, and I passed, I got the button. But then I got impatient, and it was a question of joining up. I was fed up with marching, those fucking field days, you know what they're like. And I think I wanted to get in the RAF, I'm not sure. But the queue for the Navy, probably at Reading somewhere, was very small, and the queue for the other was very large. So that was it. I got into the smaller queue.
Was there a selection process for the Fleet Air Arm at all, for air crew at that stage?
I can't remember. I'd already been through all that nonsense anyway. But there must have been. I think practically everybody in the Oxbridge lot were sort of officer class, so we didn't go through that. We had extraordinary medicals.
What did that involve?
Well, you were asked to pee in a bottle, and if you couldn't, you borrowed somebody else's. And doctors stared up your ass and grabbed you by the balls, and that was all.
Were they interested in eyesight and hearing as well?
Yes, but that was pretty simple, because I had a friend who was colourblind, completely colourblind, and he passed, and he went through the whole war. When you take red and green, starboard and foot, absolutely amazing.
So was it more really involved with just general health rather than, because I would have thought that was pretty important really, to check out eyesight at that stage.
I would have thought very, but there were very disturbed times, of course, because the bombing that was at Pompey, or at least St Vincent Leon Solent, January, and all the bombing was going on, and commercial roads had been destroyed, and we were out half the night. I was attached to a sort of mini fire pump, which was, that was quite fun. The lorry was driven by a wealthy wren, and we used to stop at the pubs and get pissed and then wait for the bombs to come down and then go out. There were some other buggers, of course, on what we call the pick and shovel parties. They were horrid, they were getting bodies out and things. But that was
were you looking for incendiaries then? With the, was it the smaller?
No, we were just out there to put out fires. But it was all rather sad in some ways. They had these big static water tanks, and then I remember one day I came across a fire crew, and I suppose whoever it was, the lead man was crying because his couplings, came from another county, wouldn't fit up with the water couplings in whatever they're called. And there's nothing they could do about it. Incendiaries are a bit of a joke. They made a pop, but you could kick them off a roof and so forth. It's sometimes frightening when they get stuck in a stick of them.
And were you training? Is that where you went to? So was it St Vincent you went to?
Well, that's where you go to learn to be a sailor.
What was that like? Because I take it that's very sort of basic naval training that you had at that stage.
Well, it was, but I remember our introduction from the captain. He stood up and he said, "In the event of an invasion, you will go down to the sand dunes and fight until the last run." And of course, I must have been one of the few who'd ever fired a rifle. It was very pathetic, you know.
Did that involve a lot of kind of drill at that stage?
Yeah. There again, that was a bit of a joke.
I take it you would have done drill already with the OTC, so relatively easy to do, would it?
Yeah.
But were you given, at that stage, were you given command of sort of a drill squad? Did you take turns in doing that sort of thing?
I took turns in it, but I was in a term called Collingwood E, which had some very tough New Zealanders and Australians. And the rest of us, I think, were all sort of public school boys. And we took the mickey out of the petty officers as much as we could. When you were invited to march a squad across, everybody would take damn good care not to hear the halt sign and walk into the walls. But we got on very well with it. They gave us murder, those petty officers, but they protected us if anything really serious happened. And of course we met them during the course of the war later. And we used to, one horrible exercise was rowing a cutter out
Why was it horrible?
Well, because they usually charge you. A, because probably only a quarter of the crew had ever rowed a boat before, and B, because they'd get you in when it, just as the tide was turning, and you'd have to row back up to the gut. And you really, really sweated your guts out. But the chap in charge of that I used to bribe with beer in the canteen at night, so I only had one just
With the petty officer instructors that you had, how did they treat you? Because you hear an awful lot about bullying in the armed services today. Was there any of that at that stage, or was it...
Oh, I don't know. I mean, on the parade ground, there were filthy mouths and abusive and so on and so forth. But in the canteen, afterwards, they were happy to, for us to buy some drinks. You know. No, I can't ever remember any bullying at all. Verbal abuse, of course, but that was in public. No, I never knew any bullying in the Fleet Air Arms Station.
What about your accommodation at St Vincent? What was that like?
Well, we had to sleep, because of the bombing, we had to sleep either on or under the canteen tables, not the canteen, the mess tables, on the ground floor. Food was filthy, of course. But it was, when you're young, it's all a big joke for a lot of people. I had a Welshman in, I think, a sweet boy who's, and his mother was pretty poor, and I used to pay him to stand my watches and that sort of thing. So you could get away with murder. And there was a great trip. We had a mast. We had to go up and down this bloody mast. And
what was that like, climbing the mast?
Well, that was all right. There was what they call a lubber's hoe. You know, it's a sort of netting that goes around and flew up the top. And you could either go through the lubber's hole or you went upside down. That was really quite enjoyable, because I used to climb up there when I was off duty at air raid sometimes, and you could actually see the German planes silhouetted against the cloud, you know. And then some boy fell off it and went through the safety netting. And then it was blown out of the ground by a bomb. So that was the end of that mass.
Are there any other parts of the training there that you remember or that stand out?
Oh, gosh. Splicing wire, I think, was the most horrid one of all. A petty officer used to have sort of crooked fingers, and he'd say, every finger like a marlin spike, and he'd...
How do you splice the wires then?
Well, like you splice ropes. And you use a marlin spike, but all these little strands, you know, they pricked you. Hands were covered in black grease and blood. The Morse code was fun. All those things, signals.
What was the move for your class then, or your course? What was the next move for the...
Well, I was very lucky, because we were all split up. Some went to fighter units, some to torpedo units, TBO units. Some failed. And I was on the first course to be sent to America. We went to Pensacola, and we were, because America wasn't in the war then. So while we were sure we had to wear civvies, we just wore American khakis on station. But I was lucky, because my old man had a friend in America who opened a bank account for me, so I was able to buy a car and that sort of thing, you know. I had a very, very lucky life.
How was it organised at Pensacola? Was it RAF instructors?
No, it was all American. It was all part of Lease Land, I think.
So how did that work then? What was the setup?
Well, we had our own barracks, and then we just be taught to fly like you would anywhere else. Yeah. Taught how to break airplanes.
What were the American instructors like? What was their background, and how did they treat you?
Well, they were all regulars. Cosmopolitan guys and extremely nice, very courteous, hospitable. There was always one or two arseholes, of course, in life, but the Americans are absolutely terrified of buggery. So nakedness in amongst men is considered a heinous crime. And I remember one officer the day coming round, he wasn't an instructor, but he found us all wandering about without any clothes on. He nearly had a fit.
So they have a completely different outlook and view on that sort of thing, don't they?
Well, I thought so. We were brought up from small children. Everybody wandered about naked in the showers, and we swam naked and so on and so forth. But they had a completely different outlook.
Did they have a different outlook towards discipline at all?
We didn't really come under them, discipline. We had a Lieutenant Commander Kennedy with us who was responsible for our discipline, but we weren't undisciplined. We got into trouble enough. But our discipline, as it's commonly recognised, no, I don't think. I never heard of anybody who refused to carry out an order. And then we went on from there. Those that passed went on to finish up at Miami.
What were the aircraft, though, that you were learning to fly on then in the United States?
Started off with biplanes. SNJs, I think they were called. Then we went on to Harvard's, did a few things on float planes, and then on to Brewster Buffaloes, which is a real death type of a plane.
What was the Brewster Buffalo like? Can you give me a
Well, it was kind of flying peanut. And it did. It was difficult to get out of a spin. If you got out of a spin and pulled on too early, it went into another one. It was really quite frightening. Yeah. The Americans fought them in the beginning of the war out in the Pacific. I've got all the pictures everywhere, but you must have them. There isn't a buffalo at Duxford.
With the flying, how had you taken to the flying?
Well, how did I take to it? Well, it's just like riding a horse.
Did you find it easy as to learn to fly?
Well, it never occurred to me to find it was easy or difficult. I mean, you were just told what to do, shown what to do, and that was it.
And what would you feel like when you soloed? Was that a...
Nothing particular. Yeah. If you didn't solo within 10 hours, you were out, I think.
But you didn't encounter any problems during the training, anything that you couldn't get right, or...?
Oh, yes, all sorts of things. Slipping and side-slipping and this and that. I pranged a few aeroplanes. In fact, the association wrote to me and asked me what I wanted on my obituary. And I sent them a list of 10 airplanes I'd crashed. And said that was all. Just headed how to fly in 10 easy lessons.
Is there any incidents that stand out where you crash an aircraft? or had an accident?
Oh, yes. Well, there was the first N3N, I think, I crashed a nice instructor, Texas. Texan. Smoked a cigar the whole time. He got out of the plane and it was standing on his nose. He said, "I'm never going to fly with you again, you fucking liar."
What had happened? How did you get the plane on its nose?
Well, I misunderstood what he said. He said, "Go take off again or go run." And I thought he said, "Stop." And I put my feet on the brake. That was all. And there were the usual ground loops, all those sort of things everybody had.
What is a ground loop?
Well, you spin around on the deck. The Harvard was particularly bad at that.
What usually causes it most then?
I don't know, dropping a wing or perhaps misaligned brakes. It wasn't serious unless you tipped the aircraft over so that you bang the wingtip. You know. But Miami was great fun because we were hosted by the wealthy millionaires down there. And there was a guest list up every night. You'd go to any party, felt like. Oh, yes, that was good news.
It must have been quite a contrast, obviously, from going from the kind of austerity in Britain to America.
Yeah.
Was that very noticeable amongst everybody?
I don't think it was, because the food that they made, we didn't like American food, I remember that. You know, they have jam with their bacon and eggs and an awful lot of those weenies, which I couldn't bear.
Did you get along well with the Americans? And what kind of views did they have on the war so far?
Well, coming back in buses from Miami to the station, there would often be belligerent Americans trying to pick a fight. But they were lower deck people, were ignorant American. Whereas the chief of police was a darling. If we hadn't got the money to get back for some reason or other, we'd make a fuss somewhere and he'd arrest us all. Put us in Cherokee for 5 minutes and then send us back in a police van. He's a wonderful chap.
But at that stage, would you have still had the naval airman's rank?
Oh, yeah. No, we were leading. We were cadets, of course, but we were leading things. We had this anchor, whatever that, Killick, so called. Leading, I don't know, seamen in a way, but.
And would you dress as a seaman at that stage? Is that why?
Not in America. Maybe after they came in the war. Here, yes, it was. We were dressed as seamen, and women used to, ladies used to come along, put their hands on you. You know that Nelson's collar is considered lucky, apparently. Come down the street and put their hands on your back. Yeah.
It's been quite strange when it first happened.
Yeah. The only difference was that we wore a white band on our caps to show we were cadets. Yeah.
Was it a big step up, obviously, from the biplane that you were training on to the Harvard being a more powerful monoplane? Was there any differences that you noticed in the flying?
Well, there must have been different. I've got a logbook here, I have to check up. There must have been different types of biplanes, don't we?
So, as the training was coming to an end in America, what's your status then? Is that at the point where you get awarded your wings?
You get your wings, yes, and your commission.
And do you know what type of aircraft you were? Because you did say that people were divided up into different types of aircraft. Were you aware at that stage what you would be doing?
Yes, yeah. Because our CEO at Miami was a chap called Charles Evans. He was a fighter man, biggest bullshit artist in the Navy, but a wonderful chap.
And what were you chosen for at that stage?
Well, we were all fighters at that stage. Some people didn't make it, of course.
Had you wanted to be involved with fighters? Was that the direction you'd wanted to go in when you started to
fly? Well, if I was going to fly, yes. Because I was a good shot. I'd spent my boyhood shooting. Oh, yes. And, of course, in the torpedo planes, the TBRs they were called, the observer was captain of the aircraft, which could have been presented problems, couldn't it?
So how did you return back to the United Kingdom?
I went to New York, where we had a hotel that was called HMS Saker 2. I think it was one of the Plaza hotels. And then I joined a ship called the Biter, which was being commissioned. Rather pointlessly, I suppose, as they only had four swordfish there. And the pilots of those soon broke them. So instead of protecting this enormous convoy, we being in the middle of it, being protected. Captain Abel Smith, skipper of the Royal Yacht later. Nice chap. We had in the Navy, if you wanted to grow a beard, you had to ask permission to grow, as you know. And faced with this awful 6 weeks convoy, wherever you go, I asked him permission to grow, which I was given. And then as we were coming into the roads at Liverpool, I corrected him about the identity of an aircraft. And he lost his temper with me. And he said, "I will not have unshaven midshipmen on my bridge." So I went there. He came up 5 minutes later. And I asked permission to shave off. Yeah. Well, it was a joke to be had.
What was it like crossing the Atlantic at that time? Because you were right in the middle of the U-boat
war. Yeah, all that too. I don't think one. I crossed it several times. There was only one occasion where I think there was trouble. Once we went over on the, would it be the QE1, because we travelled alone in that. Everybody worried that something was going to happen.